America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. As most of you know who listen regularly, a few weeks ago I spent, I don't know, about 4 or 5 days, we had fill-in hosts for 3 days in Germany. And it was the 50th anniversary of a charity that I've worked with for 30 years. And traveling across Germany, everywhere you see solar panels on the roofs of, I'd say, a third of all the houses that I saw. It's just absolutely incredible how they are solarizing. They have now, since the year 2000 in Germany, in just seven short years at the most, they are generating enough solar electricity through this program that is government subsidized and with mandates to the banks that they have to finance this, but also backups to them. They are generating enough electricity that they didn't need to build a nuclear power plant, and they expect by next year or the year after they will have not needed to build 2 nuclear power plants. Should we have government intervention in the energy market in the United States? Should we be promoting, for example, the use of energy-efficient light bulbs? Sam Kasman thinks not. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the general counsel, and heads the CEI's Death by Regulation Project, Competitive Enterprise Institute's website, cei.org. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey, good morning. So right now, China has announced that they are going to mandate in the country of China within the next 3 years, that you can no longer buy incandescent bulbs. You can only buy fluorescent bulbs or LED bulbs. Why should China and Germany be ahead of the United States?
Well, you know, China is well known as a freedom-loving democracy, and so I think this is a big blow to civil liberties in China, and I'm really shocked. Look, I think the real reason is these are being touted as something that, yes, they do cost you more when you buy them, but they more than make up for it as you use them. And lots of people believe that is correct, and they've gone out and gotten these bulbs, and they're happy with them. Others, including myself, have gone out and gotten them, and they're not happy with them. And so the real question is, why not just leave it up to people to decide? I mean, there are certain cases where they are really good. There are other cases where they're so-so. And there are other circumstances under which they are really lousy. I don't see the need for this government involvement in the most minute aspect of daily home life, all for some alleged purpose or another.
But you talk about China being a bastion of liberty, obviously, tongue-in-cheek. And I absolutely agree with you on that. But we're talking about a situation here where, according to reasonable statistics, and this is from the Environmental Protection Agency, if every American home replaced just one light bulb with an Energy Star qualified bulb, the United States would save enough energy to light more than 3 million homes for a year, more than $600 million of annual energy costs, and prevent greenhouse gases equivalent to the emissions of 800,000 cars. We're talking about millions of tons of carbon dioxide not going into the atmosphere. How much freedom do we have if our environment melts down around us, Sam?
Well, look, first of all, I don't see the environment melting down around us, but you know,
haven't noticed what's going on in the Arctic?
Yeah, but have you noticed what's going on in the Antarctic, where sea ice is at the record maximum levels? But I mean,
only in part of the Antarctic, the large chunks of the Antarctic, only in the high mountains, it's shearing off along the coasts.
No. Reports of sea ice, floating sea ice around the Antarctic, they are at their maximums, at their record maximums. Now,
right, because it's sliding down off the continent.
And it's still floating around. Antarctica is growing.
That's not what we want. That's not what we want, though. We don't want the ice on the continent of Antarctica to start melting and sliding down into the ocean, because that raises sea levels.
Look, I'm talking about sea ice in Antarctica.
That's what I'm talking about, too.
I don't want to get into a discussion of glaciers. I'd like to talk about light bulbs. Okay,
well, see, I think that they're connected.
What's that?
I think they're connected.
Everything's connected, and if you really think we face a global warming crisis, then let me tell you, China is taking the right direction, not because of its light bulb mandate, because of its one child per couple mandate. The only real way you're going to reduce man-made CO2 emissions is going to be by drastic population control. Because let's face it, you can plug in all the compact fluorescents you want. You can buy all the hybrid cars you want. You can put up all the solar panels you want. All of that will be wiped out if you have more than a replacement number of children, because they're going to grow up with their own households and get their own appliances.
I don't disagree. And what we find if you look at cultures all across the world is that those cultures where women have relatively equal power with men are cultures where you get zero population growth. So, you know, I'm all in favor of empowering women around the world, and particularly in the United States. And in fact, large chunks of the United States do have zero population growth. But the fact of the matter is we have over 300 million people in this country right now, and you have a choice between burning a 100-watt, you know, incandescent light bulb, a technology that Thomas Edison invented over 100 years ago, or you have the ability to get the same amount of light out of a bulb that produces that consumes a fraction of that amount of energy.
You know, we had a little experiment in the U.S. along these very lines back in 1987. There was the little town of Traer, Iowa. Its municipal utility basically persuaded 70% of the households to replace their incandescents and get free compact fluorescents in their place. 70%, that's a huge participation rate. And the net result was that residential electric use actually increased by about 8%. It did
I
go
would
down,
suggest
it went up.
This was, you're talking technology that's 20 years old.
No. The reason here was
in 1987.
Nature, which is hundreds of thousands of year old. Namely, once people got these compact fluorescents, because the whole idea of this experiment was to save electricity, once they got them, they understood, you know, it's much cheaper to run the lights now, and they basically ran the lights much longer than they did in the past.
I don't think the cost had anything to do with it. In 87, electricity was virtually free in the United States. It was so
inexpensive. Well, folks were paying bills back then, and they're paying bills now. That was not the case. And look, if 70% of the households did this in order to save on their utility bills, that meant it was a factor of, you know, to be considered. It wasn't getting free candy here. So,
yeah,
but let me tell you, you know what LCPA says about fluorescence? They give these really detailed instructions what to do if they break. And the very first instruction is open the windows and leave the room for at least 15 minutes, okay? Now, personally, I don't find that a very encouraging piece of advice. And, you know, I've had a lot of light bulbs that have just fallen out. I'm trying to change them. They slip out of my hand. They fall and break. The notion of going through EPA's seven-step guidelines, the first of which is get out of there, you know, it's not the sort of appliance I'd want to get.
This is because of the mercury vapor that's in them. And I agree with you on that point, but, you know, there's a larger picture here. First of all, the amount of mercury that is in one of these complex fluorescent bulbs is a tiny fraction of the amount of mercury that's emitted into the atmosphere by a comparable incandescent bulb using electricity generated by a coal or oil-fired power plant.
You have
a choice. Do you want the?
I've never had to leave the room in the house and put up the windows just because a bulb has broken. And you know, I'm not all that keen on.
Well, that's why, you know, the LED, these new LED lamps are a great advance, and I think that it's a marvelous thing. And if we're going to really push a technology, it should be the new LED lamps because they don't contain
mercury.
And they
may be fantastic. And I think if you want to get government involved in this, and evidently you do and I don't, but if you do, the way to do it is to start adjusting, you know, to start really raising the price of electricity, because then people respond even more to efficiency savings, right? But why not do it that way instead of this command and control where everyone who hates them has got to start using them? And there are
the main reason why I think most people would oppose raising the price of electricity is because the economic policies that have been in place in the United States since basically the election of Reagan, rolling back the New Deal, have led to largely a destruction of the American middle class. And you've got people who you increase their electric bill and they're not going to be able to pay their mortgages. Right now you've got people who can't pay for their medicines because we don't have national health care in this country. The economic policies that you're advocating have thrown so much of America into the edge of poverty that they couldn't deal with an increase in electric bills.
Look, if it's energy prices that are, you know, that critical to people's economic situation, those people are all the more likely to go out on their own and look for savings and efficiencies. Okay?
Well, many of them can't afford to. I mean, many of the, you know, the cost,
then,
of, yeah, I replaced
then,
all the bulbs in our house,
and
it cost me over $100.
Why start outlawing this, you know, this incredibly simple piece of technology just because you don't like the fact that people use it?
Oh, I'm not suggesting we should outlaw incandescent bulbs.
Well, but you've got this bill that Bingaman just pushed in the Senate a few weeks ago, and there's a counterpart in the House that essentially sets efficiency standards for bulbs, which are going to prohibit incandescents. And you've got
there are incandescents that are actually efficient, the ones that have the noble earth gases in them, the xenon bulbs or whatever they are.
Fine, they'll hang around. But the fact is, the conventional incandescent is going to be a thing of the past. I think that's sort of sad.
Yeah, well, you know, so's the buggy whip. Anyhow, people can check out your thoughts on it over at CEI.org, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sam Kasman, thanks for talking with us, Sam.
Good talking to you. Bye.
Have a great one. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
America. Well, you know, we can make it a better place to have a day in the life. We really can. We've done it before. One, replacing one single bulb, one single incandescent light bulb with a fluorescent bulb will keep a half a ton of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere over the life of the bulb. If every household in America replaced just one bulb, we could retire 90 power plants, 90 average-sized power plants. This is big consequences. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone from, in 1960, 310 parts per million. Today, it's 390 parts per million. That's about a 20, if I'm doing my math right, it's almost a 25% increase, about a quarter higher, about a 20% increase. And now Science News is reporting a study that was published. Oh, let's see, where was this thing published? Well, I'll get to it in a minute. Anyway, the study was done at the Academic Anxiety Center at the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands, and Science Daily here, the inhalation of carbon dioxide, CO2, triggers emotional distress and a panic response in healthy individuals. They think that this is an inborn survival instinct because, you know, there are stories, you read these stories from time to time about people who got overwhelmed by carbon dioxide because they were near, for example, hot springs are notorious for this, where the volcanic hot springs and sulfur dioxide or carbon dioxide comes up, you know, bubbles up through the water, and it's heavier than air, and so it just creates an inversion layer sort of there, and people just die of asphyxiation. They can't get out. They can't breathe. And that we have a biological carbon dioxide sensor built into us, and it triggers what's called the false suffocation alarm. And to test whether this actually works, they took 64 subjects, and they had them inhale increasing doses of carbon dioxide from 0 to 35%, and then, you know, fill out questionnaires. And they found that there was a dose-dependent negative emotion. The higher the CO2 concentration, the stronger the panic. I think it's interesting. So many people these days are on antidepressants and dealing with panic disorders. I wonder if there's a connection there. Anyhow, getting back to the larger issue here, legislation being proposed to increase the energy efficiency of light bulbs. You know, what a novel idea. And other appliances. I think it's a fine idea. There are times, frankly, when I think it's really good for government to intervene, and then there are times when it seems kind of silly. Hillary Clinton, for example, floated the idea last Friday of giving every newborn baby a $5,000 baby bond. Here's $5,000. Put it in the, you know, invest it in the stock market. You too can become the Bush family. You too can become part of the investor class. And in fact, under the Bush tax cuts, you only pay 15% income tax on the money that you make growing up rather than sitting on your butt around the pool. Instead of the 30-some-odd percent that those of us who work for a living make. The rationale, this is one of those ideas that, you know, sounds nice. In fact, England is doing something like this, only it's a much smaller amount of money. And maybe as a small seed amount would be a good idea. But it covers up, in a very real way, I think that this is putting a Band-Aid on a cancer. Hillary Clinton is suggesting that this $5,000 baby bond is going to cause people to want to save. It's going to get them involved in the stock market. They're going to start thinking like, business people, I guess. And that by the time they're old enough to go to college, it'll be enough money that they can cash it in and go to college. Or they can cash it in and buy a home. And the fact of the matter is that if you start out with $5,000 at birth, by the time you're 20, you're going to have a whole pile of money. It's going to be a couple hundred thousand, depending on how the stock market does. It's going to be a couple hundred thousand bucks. It could be a half million. Depends on the, you know, rate of return you can get. But it's going to be a lot of money. But this begs the question, why not just give free college education to people right now? Why do we have to wait 25 years? Why not just say, we're going to do the same thing France and Germany and you know, most of the other developed countries of the world do, Japan, Norway, Sweden, Finland, I believe the United Kingdom. We're going to simply say, hey, if you're capable of going to college, you can go to college for free because that's our investment, we as a society, in you so that you can become more productive so our society will grow. And if you want to buy a home, let's do something like the GI Bill and let's back those home loans in ways that are meaningful, not just profitable. Not just hustling people to, you know, as has been done in the last five or six years with Mr. Greenspan dropping the interest rates and also deregulating the mortgage market. Let's not do it in a way that basically sets people up to fall over. Let's do it like they did with the GI Bill back in the 40s and 50s, where we're backing people up. I mean, if the goal is to have an America where people can get to college and buy a home. Why give babies $5,000? Why not just say right now, we're going to help you get a home and we're going to help you go to college? I don't get it. Maybe I'm missing something here, but I don't get it. But the bottom line, there is a time for government intervention and there is a time not for government intervention. By the way, a time for government intervention right now, this war tax, Nancy Pelosi shooting herself in the foot. I want to tell you about this after the break, and then we'll take your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Gerald Iser, remember him? The guy who really started the recall Gray Davis, kick out Gray Davis and bring in ultimately it ended up bringing in Arnold Schwarzenegger. He thought it was going to be bringing himself in. He broke down in tears when he realized it wasn't. Put over $1 million of his own money into that thing. Anyhow, Daryl Issey yesterday questioning Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater, wanted to get it on the record that people from Prince's firm that they weren't just all Republicans, even though his family is really heavily tied into the Michigan Republican Party and the DeVos family and all this other stuff. And so he wants to get it on the record. So he says, here, hang on just a second. Got to turn this up.
Do you know about that?
Let's start.
I think it's germane today. And I heard a rumor that your company or someone in your company had given to the Green Party. Do you know about that?
Could have been.
Okay. I just wanted to know that there were people on both the far left and the far right relative to the chairman who may have benefited by your company.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that, in fact, some folks in Blackwater apparently did give to the Green Party. if Daryl Issa is right, it was in Rick Santorum's Pennsylvania race where they were trying to give money to the Green Party to blow up the Democrats, to provide competition to the Democrats so Ricky Santorum could win in Pennsylvania. Anyhow, it's politics, right? It's politics. Meanwhile, we've got some really, really competent folks here, some really decent politicians who are suggesting, and Congressman David Obey from Wisconsin is the guy who's the lead on this, and I strongly recommend that you contact him. If you go to callcongress.org, you'll find toll-free phone numbers for Congress. Call David Obey's office and your member of Congress and say, you know, we're with you. This is and for that matter, call Speaker Pelosi's office, Nancy Pelosi's office, and say, what? Here's the deal. What he's saying is, okay, George, you want money for your war? Raise taxes to pay for it. You're not going to borrow any more money for this war. You've already borrowed $400 or $500 billion for this war and what's now an occupation. You've already borrowed $500 billion, $400 and some change billion dollars for your occupation of Iraq that was supposed to pay for it. So remember Paul Wolfowitz? Oh, it's going to cost a maximum of $2 billion and it'll pay for itself with oil revenue. Right. You've already borrowed $400 billion from our children and grandchildren. You're not going to borrow any more. No more free ride, George. 15% tax increase on the wealthy, 2% tax increase on the middle class. If you want to have your war, you get to pay for it. This just makes absolute perfect sense. And how Nancy Pelosi could say that she doesn't support it just boggles my mind. I don't get it. The Democrats really need to learn how to play politics, and particularly with an honorable and appropriate crusade. I mean, you know, not to use the word that probably shouldn't be used, but here's the point. If Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats were to go out and say and push this really hard, yeah, Dana Perino yesterday, the White House spokesperson, she says, oh yes, this is the Democrats wanting to tax and spend. Well, why wasn't there a Democrat immediately, knowing that the White House would say this, why wasn't there a Democrat immediately calling all the news media saying, put me on camera? Yes, we are the party of tax and spend. The Republicans are the party of borrow and spend. We do not believe in spending money and leaving the bill to our children and grandchildren. George Bush does. There's something fundamentally wrong with that. Why don't the Democrats frame this issue? Here's David Obey giving you this marvelous opportunity, Speaker Pelosi. Please take it. Please take it. Everett in Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, Everett. Welcome to the program. You're on the air. Everett? Yes. Yes, sir. Everett, your phone is breaking up. I'm going to put you back on hold here, and you can talk to maybe Lauren can help it. We can help it out. Bill in Seal Beach, California. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
I want to just make a quick comment about Ms. Pelosi. If she doesn't stop acting like a Republican and act like a Democrat, I'm going to start voting for Republicans.
Well, this is, you know, what you're saying is what Harry Truman said. Harry Truman, the great Democratic president, who said that if voters are faced with a choice between a real Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, they'll choose the real Republican every time. And he was saying that in the context of trying to tell his own party to start behaving like Democrats.
Yes, sir. Can I just make my last comment I wanted to make?
Certainly.
Ms. Clinton wanting to give me or give kids $5,000. You know, wasn't there a $300 billion surplus when the Clintons left? If they would have given each American $1 million in bonds, you realize how stimulated our economy would have been, even at the lowest rate of return on bonds now. That would have been $40,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, what if they, even now, you want to be fiscally responsible? Why don't they take $350 million out of this war fund and give us all bonds? And we can go to a financial advisor. I mean, we'd own it. You want to get political capital?
I think you're absolutely right, Bill. Here's my complaint or my concern about this. And it all goes back to Michael Moore's movie. He said it so eloquently. It was one of those extraordinary moments. And if you haven't seen Sicko, you must. And this is really the essence of the movie. He said toward the end of Sicko, ultimately, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, so it's probably not a verbatim quote, but he said words to the effect of, ultimately, what we have to decide as a society, we Americans, is are we going to be a we society or a me society? And in my opinion, taking $30 billion and giving every new baby $5,000 is encouraging the idea of a me society. When in fact, we should be investing in the commons. We should be growing and becoming and strengthening the we society. We should be investing in our schools. We should be investing in our infrastructure. This is very straightforward stuff. The difference between a we society and a me society. And it just concerns me to hear me society stuff coming out of Democrats. Joe in La Jolla, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi. I heard your idea about the light bulbs.
Yeah.
And I think that they should have a benefit so people can volunteer to distribute the light bulbs. They had enough people to have a benefit to raise, you know, capital to do the idea, then you could just go around and distribute light bulbs door to door to whoever would choose to have them.
Well, that's a possibility, but again, it's like there is an appropriate role for government, Joe. Jimmy Carter, back in the day, what year was it, 79, declared that we would never again, and if we followed his legislative priorities, we would never again use more imported oil than we did in the year 1978, as I recall. And we would have gone to, and he said by the year 2000, 20% of all the electricity produced in the United States will come from solar. And it would have. And Reagan comes into office and takes the solar panels off the roof of the White House, and that's the end of that. Bernard in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Hey, Bernard.
You know, I was listening to that guy about the light bulb.
Yep.
Florida Power and Light now is passing those bulbs out. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, but good on them for doing it.
They figure if it can eliminate them having to build another coal-fired plant, there'll be money ahead. And it will help the environment besides.
And well, that's great.
Florida Power Light, by the way, is the largest producer of wind energy in the United States.
Is Florida Power and Light a public utility or a private utility? Do you know?
Well, it's on the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay, so it's publicly owned, publicly traded.
Sure, they sell stock.
Interesting.
They're going to build a solar-powered plant, an additional one in California in the Mojave Desert and in Florida. And they're taking orange peelings left over from, you know, orange juice and making ethanol.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I used to believe in ethanol. Not anymore. You know why? First of all, you don't get as much power out of ethanol as you would out of diesel fuel, biodiesel.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This is why Germany has gone entirely to biodiesel rather than to ethanol.
And
what you find is that those countries that are basically on the equator, where it's really easy to grow sugar, are going to ethanol, like Brazil. And those countries that are in the more temperate regions, like we are, and the European countries are going with biodiesel. You're absolutely right. Peter in Midland, Michigan. Another Michigan call. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I had to call and set the record straight on what your guest was saying about the sea ice.
Yeah.
I'm one of 1,000 climate speakers that was trained by Al Gore in Nashville with some of the nation's leading climate experts, and we're specifically out here to kind of shoot down misinformation like that.
Good on you, Peter.
What he's talking about is that there's been a bit of an anomaly, a one-year anomaly in the growth of sea ice around Antarctica this year. It comes and goes. But to compare it to what's going on with the collapse of the North Polar ice cap is totally an apples and oranges comparison. Your listeners should know that the sea ice at the North Pole has been collapsing 100,000 kilometers a year for the last 20 or 30 years. And this past summer collapsed by more than a million. So
yeah,
it's accelerating.
It's
up there.
Dramatic. Thank you, Peter. Thanks for setting the record straight. Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I'm that good feeling, I'm that voice. Yeah, you know who I am. Listen or not, it's your choice. Yeah, you know who I, you know who I am.
Well, we're doing our best at it anyway. This Saturday, by the way, I will be speaking in Washington, D.C. For those of you in the area, drop by the Washington, D.C. Green Festival. We'll be up on the main stage at 6 p.m. And I believe we're going to have copies of my new book out. I just got an advance copy in the mail. Cracking the Code, the book that we wrote on the air here earlier in the year and late last year. And it is out, or will be out shortly, and hopefully we're going to have some copies there in Washington, D.C. Available to folks. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont, listening to WKVT. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay, glad to hear that. Well, I'm calling you sort of as a lighting professional. I think I can safely say that more than 20 years ago, I introduced compact fluorescence in Brattleboro.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've come a long, long way. And they haven't gotten all the way there yet. LEDs are coming, but they're a couple of years away. Right now they're just too expensive. But wherever we can, we have to incentivize the use of compact fluorescence. I think right now they're the answer for probably 90%.
Well, when I was living in Vermont, we could buy, I remember walking to the hardware store, and this was subsidized by the state, you could buy the compact fluorescent bulbs for, what was it, a quarter or a buck or something like that? They were really cheap.
It's still going on as a buck, and there are some places here, one of our hardware stores does it regularly, and there's a recycling place that sells new bulbs for a buck.
And
reluctantly, I have to give a heads up to Walmart because they're promoting compact fluorescence like they're going out of style. They're trying to make they're trying to make money on it, but there's nothing wrong with that. They're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and they're also trying to make their image more green. And if they end up being more green in the process, good on them for it. Tom, thanks a lot for the heads up and for the call. I appreciate it. Len in New York City. Hey, Len. Len? All right, we'll pass on Len.
That's all right. How you doing,
Everett Tom? Roanoke, you're back?
Yeah, I had to call you back over this one, man. Hey, I just want to kind of speak my mind over this war tax because I spent a good half hour last night on the computer emailing Pelosi and Jack Murtha and David Obey because I personally think it's a fantastic idea. This is how America funded World War II. I mean, and to put this this debt on our never-ending national debt is just insanity, in my opinion.
Yep. Well said, Everett. Thank you very much. Totally with you. Paul in Los Angeles, you disagree?
Yeah, Tom. I understand the logic. I agree with the idea of putting a war tax on, but I'll tell you what the political calculus is right now that I can see. It's all about the economy and more specifically the home prices. They're just waiting. The Republican noise machine is just waiting for any kind of tax, anything to be passed by the Democrats that would affect the economy. And they'll blame the coming downturn in the house prices, which we're experiencing and we're going to experience more, and the economy itself on that. They could put a tax on horses.
The fact of the matter is, though, that they're going to blame that on the Democrats anyway, Paul.
They're certainly going to try, and
they've already started.
That's why they were so concerned in August. Congress was out when the subprime situation blew up, and Bush put out the full economic cabinet out there trying to talk this market up and trying to talk these prices up. They want the Democrats to do something so that they can pin it on them.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important that, and as I said, David Obey has handed to Nancy Pelosi a frame for this. And the Democrats need to take this frame and run with it because the American people are not stupid and they will get it. It's just that they need some leadership and they need somebody speaking out, standing up and speaking out and saying, we will not allow any more of this war, this occupation to be paid for by our children and grandchildren. If you want to have your war, Mr. Bush, you're going to have to pay for it. And
You know, it's just it's a matter of framing. And I get it that the Republicans are going to come after the Democrats, and anything that happens, they're going to say, see, we told you so, you shouldn't have raised the taxes, blah, 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 blah. But they're going to do that anyway. They're already doing that. I've heard right-wing commentators already talking about how the whole subprime thing is the result of Democratic policies and Democrats this and Democrats that. It's never going to end. We can't. And Democrats cannot refuse to do the right thing just because they're afraid that the Republicans are going to frame it in a way that hurts them.
I agree.
Yeah. So that's my message to Nancy Pelosi. And Paul, thank you very much. I understand your point. I absolutely understand your point. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Yes, I wanted to comment on this proposal by, I guess it was David Obey and McGovern, and I can't think of the third congressperson.
Jack Murtha.
Okay, fine. This just seems like a no-brainer. I mean, the problem is so many of these Republican, what I call chicken hawks, and we had this discussion on one of our radio stations here this morning in Grand Rapids, and so many of the folks that call in, they're very right-wing Republicans, but, you know, they're not in the service, their relatives aren't. And, of course, now when a tax is proposed, which you think would be the very least that people that support the war would want to patriotically support, it's, oh, no, I mean, how are we supporting it now? Well, what we're doing, as you know, Tom, is passing appropriations, but then we borrow, and who do we borrow from? Well, we borrow from governments like China and Saudi Arabia. And it would seem to me that if you really support this war, the least you could do is pay some of your income to fund it, wouldn't you think?
One would think, yeah, but that's not the logic of millionaires, billionaires, and Republicans.
But what about
the logic of the logic of millionaires, billionaires, and Republicans is I got mine and you ain't getting a penny of it.
Yeah, but how do so many of the folks that are in the working class and at the lower echelons, why do they go along with this? I mean, they call themselves Republicans, but you would think that they could see through some of this.
I think they're starting to, Rick. I really do. I mean, you look at some of these polls here now. Yesterday there was a poll on whether or not Congress, maybe it was the day before yesterday, whether or not Congress should cut back on the war funding that Bush wants. And the vast majority of Americans, as I recall, it was pushing 70-75% were saying, 79% were saying, yes, cut back on the amount of money that you're giving to Bush. Americans right across the board are saying it's time for Democrats to push back. Here's the perfect opportunity.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So what's the deal here? Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, so utterly convinced that government is a terrible thing that they systematically began taking it apart. You recall Reagan's inaugural address saying government is not the problem, or not the solution, it's the problem. Yes, let's not have governments anymore. Instead, let's have rule of, by, and for transnational corporations. What's interesting to me is the diversity of the coalition of people who find this a pretty horrific thing. Joining us right now is Jerome Corsi, a staff writer for WorldNet Daily. His most recent book, The Late Great USA, WorldNetDaily.com, of course, the website. And also the guy who wrote the Swift Boat book, which we'll talk about in a second. But, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Tom, great pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You have written a piece over at WorldNetDaily.com about the Canadian National Railways North America logo. And the basically this is the NAFTA corridor. There was a piece in The Nation a while ago saying, there's no NAFTA superhighway. You're saying, it's a super railway?
Well, this whole thing about denying this NAFTA superhighway, I think Virgil Goode, the Republican congressman from Virginia, is right. It's all just a game of semantics, a play on words by the people who want to deny the highway exists. Interstate 35 has been called the NAFTA superhighway in government reports going back to 1998. And the rail corridors, including the Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, that come down into the center of the country and join with the Kansas City Southern Railroad, which has bought railroads up in Mexico, there's a formation as well of a NAFTA super railroad structure going in place. and I've been writing about it as well. These transportation infrastructure of, on a continental basis is being constructed to transport a tsunami of millions of containers from China that are going to hit our shores over the next few decades. Even just on, off of Shanghai, they're building an artificial island that is 270 football fields in dimension, and it's going to have 30 million containers a year shipped from that one container island out in the East China Sea.
Right, and they're shipping them all over the world. But
well,
know, we're facing a tsunami right now, aren't we? I mean, this is we've seen the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs. We can't even make a cruise missile in the United States anymore without parts from China.
It's going to increase. It's going to get worse. We've lost about 3 million jobs since George Bush has been president, manufacturing jobs. And now you've got even economists like Alan Blinder, professor at Princeton, who advised Bill Clinton to pass NAFTA, says we're going to lose 40 million jobs to in the next two decades to China and India, largely with offshore, you know, outsourcing of jobs under these world trade agreements.
Here's what I don't get. We're talking with Jerry Corzi, WorldNetDaily.com, and the author of The Late Great USA. The original impetus for all this came out of the Republican Party. It came out of the ideology of let's get government out of the way, George Herbert Walker Bush's New World Order. Then Clinton came along and actually, I won't say about NAFTA campaigned against it, but basically campaigned as a Roosevelt populist progressive. And 2 weeks before he was inaugurated, Bob Rubin and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, boy, we're about to tell you the facts of life. And he governed like basically a Republican. And yet this seems to be cleaving the Republican Party, and I don't hear much about this coming out of the Democratic Party at all. What do you see as the partisan politics of this?
Well, I think first of all, you've got this is a movement from the multinational corporations. They're the ones who want to use the slaves in China and have these unfair trade agreements that, you know, don't benefit the United States or our labor market, just benefit the companies that relocate and operate as Chinese companies. The politicians of both sides of the aisle are being paid now by the multinational politicians to enact this world trade agenda.
Yeah, and this is what, yeah, I mean, because this is just what, you know, blows my mind, is that I'm sitting here talking with a guy who basically assassinated John Kerry with the Swift boat thing. And you and I are on the same side of this issue. We're both saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, America should be for Americans, and we should have, you know, our manufacturing should be here. We should have trade policies that protect businesses. So if somebody wants to start a company in the United States, they're not going to get wiped out by a competitor in China who has labor working for 50 cents an hour.
Precisely. I mean, if classical free trade, we're on the same side of this one. And even to this point of I'm supporting the labor unions and saying that, you know, without a strong labor union movement that we've had, we'd already be using slaves again in the United States, because that's what our multinational corporations of the era, going back into the 20s and 30s, that's what they were doing with the sweatshops at the turn of the century.
Sure, and it's what led to the Republican Great Depression. And, and in that, you're taking the same position that Eisenhower took. I mean, Eisenhower was a big supporter of trade unions as well, and he made that comment in a letter to his brother David about how there's a faction within the Republican Party that wants to do away with the labor unions and wants to privatize Social Security. He said they are small, they are mostly Texas oil millionaires, and they are stupid.
And he also
noted that if they ever gained power, they would destroy the Republican Party for a generation. I'd say it's happening right now.
It's happening. And I say, I call them the Rockefeller wing. You know, this is the David Rockefeller, you know, internationalist, millionaire, billionaire business people. They don't care anything about the United States of America. They're beyond God. They're beyond the United States of America. All they care about is their almighty quarterly profits. And they're happy to use slaves wherever they can find them. They currently get them in China. You know, try to form a labor union in China and see how far you get.
Right.
You'll be in prison.
You'll be in prison. Or you will be murdered in the middle of the night. I'm curious, are you, you know, as a writer and a blogger over at WorldNet Daily, the conservative site, WorldNetDaily.com, are you one of the guys who was condemning the Move On Petraeus ad?
I didn't get into that. That was not one of my issues. I didn't weigh in on that one way or the other.
What's your take on that and Mr. Limbaugh here calling our soldiers who are opposed to the war phony soldiers?
Well, you know, my position on the Iraq war is I've been writing about Iran now for 2 years, since 2004. I don't think we're accomplishing anything in Iraq either. I think I'm at the point where I think I support the troops, of course, but I think that the war in the Middle East is not the solution. I'm also not for a war going against Iran. I am not identifying at all with the neocons of the Republican Party. I think they're another dangerous influence. I think, you know, I agree that military power of the United States is limited, and we have to use it in very circumspect ways. And the idea that we're going to go over to the Middle East and get in the middle of a centuries-old fight between the Sunnis and the Shiites and solve anything, I think is naive at best.
And yet we know from Mickey Herskowitz, who was hired by George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara to write their son's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, George W. Bush's autobiography that's in print right now, an old family friend, a 30-year family friend, spent hundreds of hours interviewing George W. Bush for the book, wrote the first draft of it. And in a public interview that he gave, and he still stands behind these words, in 1999, when Bush was governor of Georgia, he said, well, actually, here's Cindy Sheehan actually quoting verbatim from this before John Conyers.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
Bush thought that having a war would make him a powerful president, and we now know, I mean, that this was something he planned from the get-go. So my question to you, Jerry Corsi, is, are you ready to apologize to America for swift-boating John Kerry?
The battle we fought against John Kerry had nothing to do with supporting George Bush, though you could not have gotten the swift-boat vets to agree on it. I voted for George Bush twice, and I think it was a mistake, but I'm not. I would have opposed John Kerry for other reasons going back to the 70s, no matter who he ran against. It's a totally different issue.
Yeah, so you're not apologizing for what he did.
No, not at all. I would oppose John Kerry again.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Limbaugh, are you condemning him?
Well, I have not gotten deeply into that one either. I've been focusing right now on this whole North American Union issue. I mean, the one I've been focusing on right now, and I was just down in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Trans-Texas Corridor, this 4 football fields wide highway that Governor Perry wants to build in Texas. They're now actually trying to extend it into
another Republican. another Republican. It's like, you guys got to get control of your party.
Tom, the issue Republican-Democrat doesn't solve it anymore.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Jerry Corsi, and people can read your piece over at worldnetdaily.com. He's the author of The Late Great USA, staff reporter. Jerry, thanks for coming on the show.
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. I want to tell you why the U.S. stock market is going up when it seems like American companies are going down right after this break, because it all ties in.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Okay, let me understand this now. Blackwater, we're privatizing our military. We're privatizing everything. We're outsourcing everything. We're doing away with the essential infrastructure of the United States and just doing away with everything and basically turning everything over to corporations, whether they be Republican-connected and big donors or whether they be transnational corporations. And so the FBI is investigating Blackwater and their behavior in Baghdad. So they're sending a team over to Baghdad to investigate Blackwater. And who, in their infinite wisdom, did the Bush administration decide to assign to the FBI investigators as they're traveling around dangerous parts of Baghdad to provide security for the FBI guys? Who's going to stand next to the FBI investigators with a submachine gun and protect them? Or perhaps intimidate? Well, who knows? Blackwater. Yep, Blackwater's been hired to protect the FBI as the FBI investigates Blackwater. This is how weird it is. Anyhow, I said I wanted to share with you how multinational corporations' stock is going up. Transnational corporations, companies like Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, Intel, General Electric, their stock is going up on the New York Stock Exchange, and yet it looks like America's being hollowed out from the inside, from everything from the NAFTA stuff that we were just talking to Jerry Corsi about. And by the way, isn't it interesting? I'm not sure if we made news or not. I don't know if he said it before. Probably should have asked. But it might be a headline tonight on MSNBC or something. Who knows that the founder of the Swift Boats Group just said he voted for Bush twice and it was a big mistake. Well, that was interesting. In any case, how is it that these companies that seem to be American companies are going up in value when America is going down in value? Our dollar's collapsing. We are becoming poorer. Well, it turns out that the reason why their stock is going up is precisely because we are becoming poorer. Because these are the companies, the blue chip companies, the big transnational corporations, the ones whose stocks are rising. They are the companies who are doing so much of their business outside the United States that a large portion of their assets are not held in dollars or are not held in countries where their assets would be denominated in dollars. Now, there's a General Electric owns a factory in the United Kingdom, and you're trying to figure out how much is General Electric worth. And that factory, say, is worth $1 billion. I'm just, you know, pulling this out of the air as a for example. And that factory is worth $1 billion. Then you say, okay, to value their stock on the New York Stock Exchange in dollars, you would say that that corporation has, among its other assets, a $1 billion asset in the U.K., but then the dollar falls 20% against the pound. How much is that asset worth now? Now it's worth $1.2 billion, $1.2 billion, even though it's worth the exact same number of British pounds. You following me? In other words, these transnational corporations, corporations who hold, as in many cases, more than half of their assets outside the United States, or do more than half their business outside the United States, all of their business interests, all of their assets outside the United States are going up in value because the dollar is going down in value. They're going up in value relative to the dollar. And so their stock price goes up. Front page story about this in today's Financial Times. I'm finding the Financial Times such a useful paper. It's now that the Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's like, you know, why even bother? And so I've subscribed to the Financial Times. Multinationals, this is from the front page. Multinationals drive U.S. rally on the weak dollar. Multinationals have emerged as the main drivers of the current U.S. stock market rally as investors move to capitalize on the weak dollar by buying into companies with large overseas earnings. They just lay it right out. They quote Joe Quinlan. He's the chief investment strategist at Bank of America. He says 2007 will go down as the year the rest of the world saved America. The belief that the dollar is going to weaken further is prompting investors to own international large capitalization stocks. Well, Mr. Quinlan, yes and no. I would say that 2007 will go down in history as the year that the rest of the world bought America, not saved America. That the culmination of 26 years of insane conservative economic policies finally reached the near breaking point and the dollar collapsed to the point relative to all other currencies or most other currencies around the world that the rest of the world was able to come in and buy us up for a song. And that's exactly what's happening. In fact, as the Financial Times says, the strong showing by multinationals comes as U.S. and foreign fund managers switch away from small capitalization and U.S.-centered companies they had favored in the recent past. It's real simple. The one other thing, the Financial Times on page 2, a big article about you know, the defense sector. The only other sector of the American economy, there's two parts of the American economy that are doing well if you look at the stock market. One is those companies that do a lot of business outside the United States. And the other is Raytheon, General Dynamics, United Technologies, basically the big defense contractors. If you're in the war business, you're doing very well. Thank you very much. 27 minutes past that.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, and yes, he's at it again, or at least the Republicans around him are. It's
condescending times, making money, selling lies. You might say everybody hates my guts.
Time for another Rush Alert.
I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cunts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi, he's a Nazi.
Yes, well, here's the House Republicans' response.
Right, you're being scammed.
To the condemnation of Limbaugh. The Democrats are saying, hey, you know, let's condemn Limbaugh for calling the soldiers phony soldiers. And the Republicans are saying, okay, here's how we're going to deal with this. We're going to put together a discharge petition to put, in other words, to launch into the legislative process their little legislation saying that it's against the law to use any federal money for anything that might resemble a fairness doctrine. Isn't that sweet?
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the...
Our limbo alert for the day. 35 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
Hey, you know, I was listening to your interview with the last guest you had, and I think you guys hit upon something. The North American Union, the NAFTA superhighway, and our trade policies through CAFTA, that is what is destroying America. And regardless of race, ethnic background, Americans who understand that issue will unite and stand. And I have one example. I'm a black atheist in, you know, the South, and I've sat in with people from the Klan. I mean, you know, Christian, white, Republican, racist, on the same issue, and we agree wholeheartedly. If we could just somehow get that message out, it will unite the whole country under one.
I think so. Bernie Sanders, for example, has been talking about this for a long, long time, and he's about as left as you can get in, he's not even in the Democratic Party, in Congress, and about as far right as you can get in Congress is Ron Paul, and he's saying the same thing. And
absolutely.
So, yeah. Good point, Andre. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Jeff in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
This North American Union – well, I want to talk about the North American Union real quick. That's not just a Republican. It's also a Democratic initiative, too.
I know. It's a big business initiative is what it is. It is a screw America proposal. It's the transnational corporations continuing the ongoing destruction of our republic.
Yeah, and the thing with Rush Limbaugh,
yeah.
I don't care what politics you are. I'm not an avid listener of him. I just happened to be listening that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's if people listen carefully, people with a brain would know what he was talking about.
Well, you mean like the next sentence where he said these guys, anybody who is serving, signed up to go to Iraq?
he's talking about people like that Macbeth guy who faked.
No, he wasn't. He later clarified it to that extent. He tried to spin it back around to that after he realized, oh, geez, I'm taking a cheap shot here. To the extent that for his Armed Forces radio version, he actually edited it. But his next statement was, these guys signed up to go to Iraq. Everybody who joined the military signed up to go to Iraq. Jeff, I ain't buying it. I'm sorry. I ain't buying it. Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn.
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm still shaking from the interview you had with your last guest, I was waiting for you to rail at him. He's a swift-boating sociopath.
Well, I gave him an opportunity to apologize, and I was...
That's not enough, though. That's not enough, you know?
Well, what, am I supposed to shoot him?
No, but I mean, apologizing is so flat. I mean, he needs to own.
I think an apology. I think the fact that the guy who was the co-author of the Swift Boat book and the head of the organization said that he had made a mistake in voting for George Bush twice. I think that in and of itself was news, Marilyn. I think that's an important beginning point. And no, I'm not going to refuse to put people on the air simply because I strongly disagree with them or I think they're toxic to America. I think we need to challenge these people. We need repeatedly. Pamela in Seattle. Hey, Pamela.
Hi there, Tom. I get so excited every time I hear you talk about the German solar program because I want to tell you that we have that also in Washington State.
Oh, in our last hour. How does it in Germany, the way it works is the banks have to make a loan to you if you own your home, and it's a 2% loan, and over a 10-year period, and as essentially a mortgage for the solar panels. And the electric company has to buy the electricity back from you at 7 times the normal retail rate, which by coincidence works out to be about exactly the amount of money necessary to pay off the loan. So at the end of 10 years, you have essentially paid nothing for the solar panel. It's completely paid off. The power company has a 50-year lifespan on the solar panels. Is that how it works in Washington State?
Well, our numbers are looking as good. We actually have net metering, which Germany doesn't have. So you get you can always be spinning your meter backwards when your home's making more than it's using during the summer.
Right.
But in addition, Washington State, through the utility, but it is a Washington State program, will pay you 15 cents per kilowatt hour just for producing green energy. Doesn't matter that you use it. You get paid for what you produce. And if you install panels made in Washington, which is going to happen as early as next year, and an inverter made in Washington, that goes up to 54 cents, which is the level at which the Germans are paid.
That's marvelous.
So, isn't that exciting? And we're telling people about this. We have our annual tour this Saturday, and actually it's nationwide. ACES.org is where people can go to find homes that they can go and visit that have solar on them here in Washington.
How do you spell that,
State?
ACES?
ACES, A-S-E-S.
ACES.org.
That's the American Solar Energy Society. Thousands of homes will be open this Saturday. Here in Washington State, we'll have over 200 now statewide. In Solar Washington is a local website, but also in Oregon they're going to have tours.
Well, that's great,
Pamela. Come out and see this.
It's a marvelous thing, and I'm assuming that Governor Christine Gregoire had something to do with this.
She did. She was very supportive.
Yeah.
And also for veterans, we're working to get programs to educate them so they can join the renewable energy bandwagon. I think people on Air America have been interviewing this fellow that wrote the article for Newsweek, and it was the focus of our ACES conference this year, was all the jobs that will be created in this country. There are American companies that are building the bigger, better batteries for the cars that we're going to be riding, being able to drive and charge off our homes that have solar energy. The we're one of the biggest makers of solar-grade silicon right here in Washington State. We have a plant out in Moses Lake. It's owned by the Norwegians, but that's the kind of thing we know we can build these industries here in this country and make a difference. And, of course, you've had on the Alliance people.
Yeah, I have. And, Pamela, thank you very much for sharing all that information. And I hope a lot of people check out the website. It's a great start. And hopefully it'll go federal. But this is, when states begin things, it gets people's attention. Jim in Anaheim, California. Jim?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to say I'm right with you on this corporate takeover of America. And I actually finished Screwed about 3 weeks ago. And like you, I cannot believe that the corporations are trying to do what they do to take away everything that we have, take away our middle class. And in fact, there's so many parts of this that it's hard to get a handle on exactly what we should do to correct it, but something does have to be done. I mean, we can't continue with 26 months. We've had 26 months of negative savings. We've had more than that many months of increasing consumer debt. We've had consumer spending declining. The housing market is about to collapse. The trade deficit keeps increasing. The budget deficit keeps increasing. National
and you're seeing the most massive shift in wealth, in assets, from the middle class to the extremely wealthy in the United States that we've seen since the late 1920s.
And it's incredible, Tom, that it used to be, I think you said maybe in your book also, that 45 times the average worker in a corporation, and now it's up to somewhere around 230 or 260. And I wrote a book based on that executive greed, mainly taking in Enron and WorldCom. It's a murder mystery. It is fictional, but it does depict a lot of the things you were talking about. So your book, Screwed, just reinforced things I've been saying about corporations since the year 2000. And we've
good on you, Jim. Good on you. Thank you very much. Keith in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Tom. I just had a comment about the we versus me society.
Yeah.
And I've been to Michael Moore's website, and I see no detailing over what he's done with the millions upon millions of dollars he's made from his movies. And at some point in time in the day, don't...
Wait a second. Keith, are you doing the old conservative, let's assassinate the messenger rather than talk about the message routine? Are you really going to try and pull that on this program?
Is there no moral responsibility personally from people?
Keith, what is wrong with the moral responsibility for paying for the things that you use? What's wrong with the moral responsibility of paying for the war that you want to have?
The tax increases that rich progressives propose have no effect on their own lifestyles. They've got their money already.
Exactly. All the more reason why you should have progressive taxation. For most of the history of the income tax in the United States, the middle class paid a very, very small percentage of the total load of the income tax. It was paid by people who most heavily benefited from the commons and the infrastructure of the United States.
How much is too much money for one person to accumulate before they should give the rest of it away?
Nobody is suggesting anybody give anything away, Keith. It's a false question. It's a phony question.
If you believe in shared prosperity, act like it.
No. Thanks a lot, Keith. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Good try. Good try. We'll be right back.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I took my problem to the KGB.
That's the Vlad Putin song.
This guy who won't agree with me. They took Litvinenko for some sushi and some wine, and just a little portion of Polonium-209.
And now Garry Kasparov is going to challenge Putin. We have some advice for him, or the Capital Steps do.
He looked suspicious when he saw his dish. He said it isn't safe to eat raw fish. They said it's okay, hey, the sushi is just fine. We're sure E. coli can't survive Polonium-209.
Yes, Mr. Kasparov, check out your sushi carefully.
He thought that Litvinenko would have made a fast break. His sake smelled like something they dredged out of a lake. What's more, the guy who served him was named Igor the Snake. And though he didn't order it, he got a shake. If I should take you out for tea or fruit, it's best to bring a radiation suit. And though I've noticed frequently my dinner guests decline, but hey, it tastes like chicken. Polonium-209.
Yes, Mr. Kasparov. Being careful, be very careful. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Ellen Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. I'm up at the Senate right now, and it's interesting here because there is, of course, this the question of whether the nominee to the Justice Department is going to go through. It looks like Senator Leahy has said and sent out actually a letter saying that he wants to make sure that he's going to keep the White House influence away from him. But a lot of people are saying that Senator Leahy is actually caving because Senator Leahy is not demanding that the White House turn over those documents. So I guess the view of Senator Leahy is in the eye of the beholder as to whether he's trying to be tough on the new nominee or whether he's caving on this issue.
Well, he's demanding it rhetorically, but he's not demanding it legally.
That's right.
He hasn't pressed for prosecution for contempt of Congress. That's the point, right?
Well, exactly, and he's not making it a condition that this nominee would go through his committee. He's not making the turnover of the documents as a condition of that.
So we have Pat Leahy wussing out on this. We've got Nancy Pelosi, David Obie, and several members of Congress, Jack Murtha, probably the most famous among them, coming forward and saying, okay, if Bush wants to have his little war or his occupation, then he has to pay for it. We're going to raise taxes, 15% on wealthy people, 2% on the middle class, to pay for the war so that we're not putting that bill on the credit card of our children and grandchildren. And Nancy Pelosi says, oh, no, don't want to do that. Don't want to do that. At what point do the Democrats stand up and say, hey, we've heard the 70% plus of the American people who want us to constrain this guy, this out of control administration and these out of control Republicans. At what point do the Democrats step up and start doing something?
Well, at the point that they go home and they take a look at their districts and they see that there may be Democratic challengers from the left, or that people are mad about the war so much that they're going to overturn the election and, quote-unquote, teach them a lesson. But I'll tell you, the only thing that's going to change it is the polling.
Yeah. We're seeing the Republican from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, has now come out and I think it's just he's looking at the polling in his own district. He's up for re-election this year or next year. And in the Senate, and he's now talking about giving the al-Maliki government, the Iraqi government, 90 days to get their act together.
Well,
a Republican.
You know, it's interesting because he's changing on sort of a lot of things as he looks at the elections. He's moving away from his sort of previous immigration status and stance, and he's hearing a lot about that in his district. He's obviously hearing a lot about the war, and he's looking over his shoulder and looking at his job.
Yeah, yeah. But the Democrats don't get it. Somehow they think that because they're Democrats, they're safe.
Exactly. Barney Frank this morning, he was chair of the House Finance Services
Speaking
Committee,
of Democrats.
The World Bank issued a report called Doing Business. Frank this morning, there was a hearing, and he completely blasted the World Bank because basically they're saying in countries such as Haiti, et cetera, very poor countries, that they are, and former Soviet bloc countries, that these are great places to do business because of the economic system, and because there's so many poor people, and he's essentially saying that national security, this is what Barney said this morning, that national security is going to be compromised if we continue to just try and essentially exploit these countries for doing these poor countries and their labor laws that many places don't exist.
It's interesting because that World Bank report in the next hour, actually, right after the news at the top of the hour, I'm going to be quoting from that World Bank report about their analysis of what the true wealth of nations is. I'm assuming it's the same World Bank report.
I think it's called Doing Business.
Yeah. And there are multiple dimensions to this report. And one of them has to do with literally the true wealth of nations, where it is, and it turns out that a lot of it is in the institutions of government. But in any case, I'll get into that after the break. But I'm with Barney Frank on this. The question is he going to do anything about it? I mean, the thing to do is to blow NAFTA, CAFTA, and all the AFTAs out of the water, shut down the WTO, or at least the U.S. walk away from it, and go back to a tariff-based trade system that protected our businesses from 1787 when it was first put into place, right up until the day that Bill Clinton took it apart in 1996.
I think you know there are too many mid-level Democrats that is never going to happen. Too many Democrats that are sort of blue dogs or yellow dogs or whatever kind of color dogs you want to make them that will never let those trade deficits and never overturn NAFTA.
that are getting their campaign contributions from multinational corporations.
Well, it's not just that. They look at certain businesses in their districts, not certainly the workers at their districts, who are saying, we need it, we need it, we need it, particularly a lot around agriculture.
Yeah. Well, that's for the exports. But these trade agreements cut both ways. You're going to allow huge exports, particularly subsidized exports. You're going to have imports as well. Just a few seconds left here, Ellen. Any other hot news coming out of Washington, D.C.?
Well, of course, the S-chip, and the president vetoed that this morning. He left the door open, quote-unquote, for negotiation. Really, the next move is really in the Democrats' court on this one.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. FamiliesUSA.org is launching a nationwide ad campaign.
And the ad campaign is great because the people are supporting the president and the kids are.
There you go. Thanks, Ellen.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes even everything that you know is wrong, as the Fireside Theater warns us.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible to easily and quickly overcome addiction, OCD, fear, stress, depression, overeating, and maybe even Republican fear-mongering? Mark Furman is with us here. He's the author of The Neurophysics of Human Behavior, his website, mindimagingtechnologies.com. Hey, Mark.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm great. You describe yourself as a mental escape artist and suggest you can do an on-air demonstration about how we can turn our dreams into reality and get rid of what's holding us back in life. You are on the air.
Well, the most important thing that we've learned that prevents us from being able to turn dreams into reality or being able to do anything that we want to do, whether it's change a thought, an emotion, or a behavior, is we've gotten the mind-brain relationship backwards. And that's a huge problem. We have this belief, primarily in the United States, that mind causes brain and that we could just think our way out of obsessive compulsive disorder or out of addictions or to lose weight or to wealth or to health or to relationships. We simply just use our willpower and think our way to what we want. And that is absolutely not true. The last 50 years of your neuroscience has proven that the mind-brain relationship is exactly backwards. That brain causes mind. It's like the relationship between you and your shadow. If you're out on a sunny day and you see your shadow, every move you make has 100% reliability of being able to move your shadow, every single move you make.
So are you suggesting that we should change our brain? I mean, is this like a pitch for EEG neurofeedback therapy, that kind of thing that actually physically modifies brain function?
Well, using neurofeedback is one way that has been found to be able to get through the loophole of this mind-brain-caused relationship. But it's only one of the first ways that it's been effective. We're still going.
But what about the studies that were done back? This is, I think, less than 10 years ago, where they were doing continuous monitoring of cortisol levels and serotonin levels in circulating blood, and they found that if a person simply puts a smile, totally phony smile, on their face and holds it there, that serotonin levels go up and cortisol levels go down. Yeah, in other words, the happiness hormone starts showing up in the bloodstream, and the panic hormone starts going away, which takes us back to what William James said in the late 19th century, that if you simply stand up, no matter how bad you feel, if you stand up straight, take a deep breath, pull your shoulders back, put a smile on your face, and take a walk, you will feel better.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That's another loophole in neuroscience that we found. We're cybernetic systems, so there are certain things that we can do intentionally that will automatically change the way the brain is releasing neurochemicals, and that is one of them. We can change our posture. We can change our speed of movement. We can put a smile on. We can laugh intentionally, and those things will make temporary change, but they will not make lasting change.
My understanding is if you make temporary change 21 days in a row, more or less 3 weeks in a row, that it becomes lasting change.
Now we're getting closer to the answer, and it's really good. See, we have in the psychotherapeutic industry, we have throughout the United States measured whether or not we've gotten a change in something by asking somebody how they feel and how intense that feeling is. It's called the SUD score, or subjective units of disturbance. And that is the most inappropriate way to determine whether or not somebody has made a change. But what you've just mentioned is the more appropriate way to determine whether or not a change has been made. We look at the frequency, the duration of the pattern that's occurred, whether it's a thought, emotion, or behavior. If the frequency or duration of the pattern increases, then the stability of that change is increasing. And if it decreases, then, of course, it's going in the opposite direction. So you're hitting the nail right on the head.
Yeah, we're talking with Mark Furman, mindimagingtechnologies.com, the website. His book, The Neurophysics of Human Behavior. Mark, this is not new stuff. I mean, Plato, Aristotle, talked about the relationship between continuous reinventing of behaviors and long-term changes in behaviors. Dale Carnegie wrote about this stuff in the 1920s. In the 1950s, you had Norman Vincent Peale and The Power of Positive Thinking suggesting that if you simply change the habits in your life with great effort every day for 3 weeks, that you would see long-term permanent changes. Is this something that we're just kind of rediscovering or repackaging with neurobiology, or is there something new here?
Good question. What's new has come from an ability to take all of this knowledge and put it against a litmus test or a crucible and say, okay, how much of this is just stuff that we want to believe and how much of it can we prove with neuroscience? The truth is that we can have some effect at being able to change our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors and results in our life given enough time and energy. But the problem is we don't teach people how. And the how is what's new.
What's your how?
Here's the bottom line. You cannot change something that is invisible. If I asked you to make adjustments to a building and that building was invisible, you would have to build some kind of a model of that building to be able to see it or feel it so that you could make modifications to it.
Oh, wait a minute. I can blow on my hand and I can feel that, you know, I can blow on a leaf and move it and my breath is invisible.
Yes, it is. So what we could do is we can see the effects of something. So if a behavior has effectively changed, we could see the behavior pop out on the other end, and we say, okay, that's changed. But then also a week later, we find ourselves doing the wrong behavior again, and we go, uh-oh, what happened? And that's because we're playing with this black box phenomenon. We're making adjustments on the inside of an invisible space, and we're hoping for a symptom to pop out called a behavior on the other end to see if we've done it right.
So what's your suggestion to our listeners?
Well, we don't have to wait that long. One of the fastest things that you could do is you can begin to draw a map or a model of your mind, and it's a very simple process to do. You take your thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, and you treat them as three different building blocks, and you simply ask yourself a question. If you're starting to feel a feeling like depression or grief or sadness or anger or fear, you simply say, okay, what is the name of that emotion? You go ahead and you name it. You draw a circle on a piece of paper, and you put it down. Then the next question you ask yourself is, what just caused me to feel that way? You need to isolate what the cause-effect relationship is in the world. So you want to be very keen about it. You want to say, well, you know, it's what made me feel fear is that car cut me off on the road, or what made me feel grief is I looked at a picture of a parent that just died. And you want to be very specific about what the cause-effect relationship is, and then you attach them together as an access code. The next thing that you do is you have to ask yourself, well, what behavior or reaction options do I have when I feel that way? And then you look at the different behaviors that are state-bound or trapped inside of that state. And as you build a map of this problem, you can find your way out of the problem 100 times faster, because when you build a map, you'll notice that it's a maze. And we get lost in the maze because we don't see it. But if I took you into a new city and I gave you a car and I said, okay, get from point A to point B, and I didn't give you a map, you'd struggle hitting every dead end to try to get from point A to point B. If I took you up for 5 minutes in a helicopter, let you see a map of the area, then brought you back down, you would clearly be able to remember which roads connect and which ones don't. And
yeah, so let me provide a very, very simple map. I would submit to you, Mark Furman, that people who are experiencing negative emotions of the high squeaky variety, the panicky anxiety variety, are imagining, or in some cases remembering, but essentially imagining, projectively imagining future frightening events.
Right.
And people who are experiencing the dark, thick emotions, shame, guilt, depression are imagining or are remembering past events and reliving them. In both cases, the thing that's common between those two experiences is that they are not being present. And if they simply look around, take a deep breath, notice what they see, what they can see, hear what they can hear, feel what they can feel, taste what they can taste, and bring themselves to the moment, they will break that state, they will be in the present, and the panic or the depression will be shed.
Yes, it can. Yes, it can. And it depends upon the stability.
I mean, this is Buddhism 101.
Yeah, it depends.
This was 3,000 years ago.
Now that you have a problem with, let's say, a person whose wife has just died and he's dealing with severe grief and depression, the stability of that state is so strong, the neural coding of it is so strong, that being present is impossible. He can't find the mechanism to be able to do that. It's just simply impossible because he can't escape the security level or the stability level of the Hebbian.
Well, that's where you use sensory input. That's where you attend to your senses very aggressively. You look at, you see what you're seeing, and then you intentionally hear what you're hearing, and then you intentionally feel what you're feeling, and then you cycle back to seeing what you're seeing.
Well,
as a way of breaking the state.
One of the drawbacks to that is that the perceptions that you have are state-bound. So if you're stuck inside of a state that's severe, the perceptions that you're going
to
have...
So that process will become an anchor to that. That's interesting. Mark, yes. Furman, Mark, we got to wrap it up. I appreciate your coming on the program. MindImagingTechnologies.com is website. Mark Furman with us, author of Neurophysics of Human Behavior. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, we are in just a few minutes going to be getting to the real wealth of nations in that World Bank study. But right now, Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, watching, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, is on the line with us. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom. That's right. We're keeping an eye for sure.
Yeah, indeed. Mandatory funding for VA health care, back in the spotlight. I'm seeing this on your website.
It is back in the spotlight. Well, first of all, if I could just backtrack a little bit, for right now, for the 12th time in the last 13 years, the VA is operating without a budget, like many other cabinet agencies. And the VA had been looking for a huge budget increase for 2008. The negotiators on Capitol Hill, as we know, haven't got that through, so the VA is stuck using a continuing resolution, spending at the 2007 level. This creates nothing but problems. We're going to see hiring freezes.
It's effectively a 3.5% budget cut, because that's how much inflation has taken out of the dollar in the last 12 months.
It really is. It is a budget cut. So we've got hiring freezes. Equipment can't be purchased. Repairs can't be made. It's going to mean longer and longer and longer delays for veterans seeking health care until we can get that budget through. Now, the concept of a mandatory budget is really kind of neat, and that is it will take it out of the discretionary process. And the bill that is now before Congress, it's in the House, H.R. 2514, will use a formula to provide mandatory funding every year for the VA, and it's based on need. You have so many veterans in the system, so many veterans seeking this type of health care. It uses cost of living adjustments, consumer price index, and it lumps that all together into a big formula and says, you need this much money, and it automatically gives it to the VA on time every year, no questions asked, no haggling, and it doesn't have a chance in heck of getting through.
Why not?
It'll be vetoed.
You don't think that the Senate and House could pull together a veto-proof majority for this?
Senate could. I don't see it happening in the House veto-proof. I really don't. And what they're going to...
Who is opposing it?
Okay, mainly the Republicans who are the fiscal conservatives, and the opposition is stated thusly. Mandatory funded programs are breaking the budget, is the argument that they use at this time, and they will point at Social Security, at Medicare, and at Medicaid, which are mandatorily funded. And they'll say, these are the examples of what is breaking the budgets back. We cannot do it. Now,
in other words, they don't want to make the VA what's called, what they call an entitlement.
That's exactly right. They do not want it to be an entitlement. And if they went ahead with this, you would have to look at two things. One, because of the pay-go system we have in Congress now, they would have two choices if they passed mandatory funding and veto-proofed it. One, they would have to offset it from somebody else's budget. In other words, take money from someone to make sure veterans are taken care of, or they would have to develop a new revenue stream. Of course, that's code for taxes. And quite frankly, I don't see the Democratic majority right now creating any new taxes. You know, they're shooting for the White House in 2008. If they do make it to the White House in 2008, I think that whole dam will burst open, and we could see mandatory funding come up and be passed in the 112th Congress. I don't see it in this Congress or in the 111th.
Right.
Yeah.
Tragically. So basically, the VA is going to be operating on this budget cut. Things are going to get worse and worse for veterans right up until the day that George Bush leaves office. We have 474 days, 10 hours, and 28 minutes to go.
Well, I hadn't checked my watch recently, but I'll take your word for that.
Yeah.
Yes, and it appears that way because Congress will be deadlocked on this, and I don't think they can get a veto-proof majority in the House. The other interesting news here, Tom, is the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission, which has been working for over 2.5 years. This was a commission appointed by President Bush to examine VA disability benefits for the first time in over 50 years. They took them apart from top to bottom, and as we speak right now, they are holding a press conference in Washington, D.C. Their full 550-some-page report will be released in just a few minutes, but one of the interesting things they're calling for is an immediate increase in VA disability benefits of up to 25% right now. Now, we also know that this will not happen. It will happen when Starbucks has a 25-cent cup of coffee, simply because of all the money involved. Now, this is what we call the headline piece. They're using this to headline their report. It's a good attention getter, but we also know this report will have some negative impact on veterans, and we'll have to look at it over the next few hours or the next day or so and analyze it, and we'll have it posted on VAWatchdog.org. But the interesting thing about this commission is it was appointed by the president. It was the appointees were a 9-4 majority appointed by Republicans. But what we're finding is that many of the people on the commission did an about-face. I mean, a 25% increase in VA disability is going to cost at least $10 billion right now, today.
Right. So, in other words, they confronted reality and they're telling the truth.
In most of the cases, it would appear so. Again, we're going to have to take a look. There are 113 recommendations. It's going to be some heavy reading.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and you'll be taking it apart in ways that people can easily understand and figure out what to do about it over at VAWatchdog.org, I'm sure.
That's right.
Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Great website. Check it out. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you again, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour, the true wealth of nations, coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
In Washington, D.C., if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, this Saturday I'll be speaking at the Green Festival there. And you can just Google the Green Festival, easy to find. At the Washington, D.C. Green Festival, it'll be at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. I'll be speaking at 6 p.m. on the main stage. So Check it out. Ronald Bailey wrote a commentary in the Wall Street Journal in the weekend edition, as I recall, about the World Bank's new study. The title of it is Where is the Wealth of Nations Measuring Capital for the 21st Century? Apparently, this is a different study than the one Alan Ratner was talking about, which is called Doing Business. I thought they may be the same. But this study pointed out that if you add up the value of all the natural capital of a nation, the stuff, literally the natural capital, I mean, oil, coal, gold, lumber, the natural gas, the cropland, all the stuff that is the value that nature has to contribute to an economy, or the value that it has to simply quiescent, just laying, you know, the oil that's under the ground that hasn't been pumped. If you add up the value of all of that stuff, what are sometimes referred to as non-renewable resources, and you add up all the stuff that is traditionally referred to as capital, that is the machinery, the buildings, the technologies that have been developed, the structures, the cities, the value of all the land and the buildings in the cities, housing, all the stuff that basically we've created and that we use. If you add all this stuff up, it comes to less than 20% of the actual value of the United States and about 40% of the value of many poor countries, the typical poorer country, Mexico, for example. So where is that missing 80% of wealth in the United States? Where is that missing 60% of wealth in Mexico? What they concluded was that this missing wealth, what they said, this is a quote from the study from the World Bank. They said, rich countries are largely rich because of the skills of their population and the quality of the institutions supporting economic activity. In other words, the court system, the stable currency, the laws that make it possible to start a business and run a business, the tax system that supports it all, the police department, the fire department, the public education system in every country except the United States, the public health system. All of that stuff, completely intangible, is what accounts for more than half of the wealth of all the wealthy nations in the world. They also point out that countries that are very low in this kind of capital, they created this thing called the Rule of Law Index. It measures 25 different variables, but it's basically all this kind of stuff. Switzerland scores 99.5 out of 100 on this index. The U.S. is 91.8%. Nigeria, 5.8. Burundi, 4.3. Ethiopia, 16.4. So the very, very poor countries, they may be sitting on a lot of natural resources. Nigeria is very wealthy in terms of oil. You know, in the U.S., our overall wealth, the natural wealth portion of it is in the U.S. only between 1 and 3%. The average wealth of OEC, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD countries, for example, $440,000 per person. That's $10,000 in natural capital, $76,000 in produced capital, and a whopping, to quote from the Wall Street Journal piece, and a whopping $354,000 in intangible capital. Switzerland is the highest in the world, by the way. We're number four. $513,000 per person is our wealth. The vast majority of that, well over $300,000 of that, is this stuff that we call government and the institutions that derive from it. Society, civil society, that's the intangible wealth. They start out the article, Ronald Bailey starts out the article asking this question. A Mexican immigrant or migrant comes to the U.S. and he's five times more productive than one who stays home. Why? In other words, he can produce five times as much wealth. And everybody thinks that the reason is because we have more natural resources, we have more tools. Not true. Turns out it's because we have more of this intangible wealth, an efficient judicial system, for example, you know, the stuff that I was just talking about. Peter Bauer, again, the World Bank study is consistent with Peter Bauer's writing, as Ronald Bailey points out in the Wall Street Journal, his 1972 book, Descent on Development. Bauer says, if all conditions for development other than capital are present, capital will soon be generated locally or will be available from abroad. If, however, the conditions for development are not present, then aid will be unproductive and therefore ineffective. In other words, if you've got a country that doesn't have a functioning civil society, you can throw all the money in the world, or they can be sitting on top of all the oil in the world, and nothing will come of it. It'll still be an economic basket case. Whereas on the other hand, if you have a country that is even very poor in natural resources, Japan has virtually no natural resources, but they have strong civic institutions, a strong culture that goes back thousands of years, then it's a nation that will become wealthy. And I would submit to you that what the me society conservatives, like the guy who called an hour and a half ago and said, you know, how much are they going to take away from me before it's too much? Yeah. The me society conservatives are aggressively and actively, and we've been watching it for 26 years now since the election of Reagan, destroying this collective wealth, this common wealth that we have. And the reason why the United States became great in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s was because we collectively were in a we society mode called the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt, 91% tax on income over $3.2 million a year. And in direct answer to that caller's question, yeah, that's where I think it should kick in, at 91%. Because it worked. And it built this great industrial nation. So, anyhow, that's my take on that. And why I think, again, that Hillary's proposal of $5,000 per baby feeds into the me society meme. And I'd much rather we be saying, instead of giving a baby $5,000 so that when they grow up they can afford to go to college, let's just all pay for college. Because we will all be repaid, because that will become part of our collective natural wealth, part of our common wealth. Roger in McMinnville. Hey, Roger.
Hi. My credentials are that I have a PhD in mathematics, so I hope you'll believe what I'm telling you. That $5,000 at 7% will only be worth $20,000 at age 20. The doubling time at 7% is 10 years.
Oh, interesting. So not only that, if it's only worth 20, if you have a 3.5% inflation rate on top of that, that $20,000 will buy what? What, $10,000 would buy today?
That's right. Much, much less than it would buy today.
Yeah. So Hillary's proposal doesn't make sense economically in any case.
It's silly.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Roger, thank you very much.
You bet.
I appreciate the call.
Bye-bye.
Rick in Eugene, Oregon. See you later. Rick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment on the Mark Furman piece.
Sure.
After having been in recovery from drugs and alcohol for a dozen years, I know that when I'm alone in my mind, I'm outnumbered, and I cannot use my mind to fix my mind. I have to do something else.
Right, and thus a 12-step program.
I'm sorry?
And thus a 12-step program?
Absolutely. And what my sponsor taught me was, when you're mired in the cesspool of your self-pity or self-judgment or whatever, you need to do something else. And the very best thing that I know, the surefire cure for me, is selfless, loving service to other people.
There you go. Well said. Very, very well said. Thank you, Rick. Yeah, but get outside yourself. Get beyond yourself. Is it Nils or Niles in Germany?
Yeah, Nils, Germany.
Hello, Nils.
My question is, why do you think that Americans are so brainwashed? Do you think it is some kind of government program, or do you think there's something in the food supply that Americans believe that they are the best in the world? Thank you.
You're welcome. If you're sticking around, we can discuss it. But if you want to hang up, I understand. I believe, first of all, that people in every nation believe that their nation is the best. That's just a natural instinct. But with regard to our pursuing insane economic policies, back about 35 years ago, a group of very, very wealthy individuals in this country got together and started funding think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute that were designed to basically brainwash Americans to thinking that the interests of the very wealthy are the same as the interests of the average person. And to some extent, they've succeeded. Does that make sense? No, I guess Nils is gone.
Absolutely.
Yep. Oh, I'm sorry. I dropped the call. I thought you were gone. But in any case, I mean, that's really the bottom line. And what we're seeing is that they were actually successful. And this goes back to a memo that was written by a fellow who ultimately became a member of the Supreme Court to the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, saying it's time for business to get together and advocate for its own interest and change the minds of Americans. And that's what they did. That's what they did throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it reached a high water mark with the election of Ronald Reagan. And we've been pursuing these insane policies for 26 years now, these insane economic policies. And guess what? We're looking back now 26 years and saying Reaganism, or whatever you want to call it, is destroying America. It's destroying us. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And also in Burma, the military junta has now unplugged the internet. Bad news. Middle of the night, they're going out and arresting and apparently murdering monks. I mean, this is just a massive and violent crackdown. And I encourage you to let your elected officials know that we should be speaking out far more aggressively, the United States, about this horrific violence that is happening in Burma. There, many other countries, many people in other countries around the world are speaking out. And China actually is, there's talk about how China is talking about putting enormous pressure on Burma. These generals cannot hold out forever. In fact, the lead guy is in his 70s. We'll see how it shakes out. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Thanks, Tom. You gave me a lot of food for thought there, but I should stick to my subject. And that is the Prez used a word that just infuriated me, I believe, in his comments about vetoing the child health care bill. I think something like, I don't believe Americans want the government to be involved in their health care. And every time...
Spoken like somebody who was born with a $10 million trust fund.
No kidding. But he uses that to appeal to the rabid right, you know, like they banned it. Oh, well, we respect your beliefs, sir, you know. And he uses a word like evil. Every time he says the word evil, the only thing I can think of is Dick Cheney. When he says the word belief, I say, I believe Bush had something to do with 9-1-1. In fact, I think he did it, and I believe he's planning on bombing Iran.
Yeah, I believe he's planning on bombing Iran too, Steve. I'm not sure about 9-11, but I wouldn't rule it out. I thank you very much for the call, and I share your cringe. Jackie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Another change of subject, if you don't mind. Do you know if there is a legislative process to remove Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid from positions?
From their leadership positions?
Yeah.
It would require a vote by the caucuses, or actually by the House and the Senate. You know, the House and Senate elect their own leadership. And for all practical purposes, the party that's in the majority elects the leader, but it doesn't always have to be that way. And in fact, I believe historically it hasn't always been that way, but typically it is. And certainly in the modern era, it always has been.
Right.
And so what would have to happen to change the equation of Harry Reid being the head of the Senate and Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House is that enough Democrats would have to become convinced that these weren't the appropriate people to be leading their party or in the House and the Senate that they would challenge that leadership.
That's my hope. Because they're not willing. They're not listening to either the people that elected them or their colleagues or most of their colleagues. And I really believe if the people in the Senate, if the members of the Senate and the House had some leadership, they might be able to get something done.
Yeah. Well, Russ Feingold is doing a really good job. I mean, he doesn't have, you know, because he's not in Harry Reid's seat, he doesn't have the power to do everything that should be done. But I'm on his email list. They're doing a fundraising thing for, I think, 40 freshmen in the House of Representatives trying to raise money to help these, you know, empower the progressives. And I would encourage you to check out Russ Feingold's website. You can probably easily Google it. I don't have it right off the tip of my tongue.
He's wonderful. I would love him to be head.
If Russ Feingold were to take Harry Reid's job, I'd be one of the happiest people around, at least for a short while.
I would join you.
Yeah, there you go. Jackie, thanks a lot for the call. John in Camas, Washington?
Camas. Yeah, hey, Tom. You know, I love your show list at all times. You know, the comments that you have about the economy are so right on target. They are just unbelievably correct. And it infuriates me when we don't see it being put forth more, which does lend us to believe that there isn't much difference at the top between these two groups of folks running things. It really infuriates me. But when I get back, I hear these folks who are supposedly good conservative Christians talk about, they don't want to talk about the greed. Well, they'll come back with a spin and say, well, I've never gotten a job from a poor man. You know, so they are always encouraging. They have swallowed the swill, and it just is so infuriating.
Which, by the way, is a lie. I have started businesses that have provided employment for probably close to 300 people in the course of my life. And the first business I started with the money that I had in my pocket, which was less than $200, and an unemployment check. And the second business I started with a $10,000 line of credit on my American Express bill. In both cases, I think I could have qualified as poor because in the first case I was on unemployment, and the second case I had no income, and I ended up hiring people. So, you know, that to say that you've never been hired by a poor person is nonsense, because what you're saying is that you've never been hired by an entrepreneur, you've never been hired by a small business person, and it's a lie.
One other thing, Tom, just real quick, I'll pass on. You know, our progressives or Democrats, whatever we want to call ourselves nowadays, there is one quote, and I know it's going to infuriate some people to quote the Bible, but there's one verse in the Bible that's 100% right when it says, it's the love of money is the root of all evil. And boy, when you look at it, it's not money itself, but the love of what we'll do for it. Oh, man, if we could eliminate that, we would go a long way to have a lot better place.
Yeah. Yeah, I think actually you're quoting Ben Franklin, but, you know, mammon over man, yes, absolutely. John, thanks a lot for the call. I do appreciate it. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's in, would it be Psalms? I'm not sure. Anyhow, tomorrow Robert Poole and I are going to debate the privatization of air traffic control. David Bloom is here on how you can make alcohol at home fuel for 40 cents a gallon. Christy Harvey with the news below the radar and your calls on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, in fact, get out there and do something about it. Democracy depends on you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.